Right now, we're doing Pentateuch. So we're in the book of Deuteronomy. And by my records, we've gone through the first 11 chapters. And we're picking up with Deuteronomy chapter 12. Matter of fact, I've got not one but two post-it notes that say start here. So it has to be Deuteronomy chapter 12. I'm not sure how I got two. Yeah, maybe that one ended up there. Could be. You might remember during the introduction, I had said that although the Bible itself doesn't tell us this, some scholars have looked at the material covered in Deuteronomy and think that in some ways, chapters after chapter 5 seem to be an expansion on the Ten Commandments. Okay, so for those who believe that, and not everybody puts a lot of credence in it, but I could see why it's worth saying. Those who say that believe that Deuteronomy chapter 12 is an expansion on the second commandment, focusing on treating God with proper respect and not, you know, portraying him through images. And we know God doesn't want to be simplified to just some image or some likeness. I don't want to read all of this, but he goes on to say, these are the statutes and judgments, chapter 12, verse 1. So, after having expanded on the general requirements for loving and worshiping God, as I said, chapters 6 through 11 are considered to be an expansion on that first commandment. You can say, love God with all your heart, your mind, and soul. You know, put him first. Now we're going to reiterate some of the statutes and judgments that have largely appeared earlier in the Pentateuch. Although we'll see some new things. But something interesting in verse 2, utterly destroy all the places where the nations you'll dispossess served their gods, on the high mountains, on the hills, and under every green tree. God did not want the Israelites to take over places of worship and just convert them to worshiping him. He said, no, I don't want you to do that. And he'll focus on the place where he'll put his name. It's worth mentioning that in the land of Canaan, there were very few buildings that were temples. The pagan worship that they had then was primarily done on hilltops in groves of trees. They would plant particularly evergreen trees and sometimes leave them intact or shave off the branches to make an upright pole. And that's where you see the word Asherah sometimes. It can mean upright pole, and it's sometimes representing Ashtoreth or Ashtaroth. So you see references through the Old Testament of worshiping in the groves or hilltops, because that's the pagan practice was done that way. And God is saying, I don't want you to do that. Do not do so. Now in Christianity, have you seen, you know, other churches doing that? Maybe you haven't. You probably not. Come to think of it, most of you have been in the church all of your life, for most of you. I'm curious, anybody here ever visited Rome? Okay, did you visit like the Pantheon. Yeah, the Parthenon's in Athens. Well, I was thinking you can go and find some ancient pagan temples where it's like they slapped a cross on it and say, now we're worshiping Jesus here. And I don't mean to, you know, I'm making light of it. They took it much more seriously. And I guess they said, hey, here's an elaborate, nice building. Let's not knock the building down. Let's repurpose it. But God specifically told his people, I don't want you doing that. Knock them down. Destroy them. Don't use their old buildings or their systems. And we would say in our modern time, it's not so much the building as adopting the customs, which modern Christianity has done that. So, oh, you've got a very elaborate festival that everybody likes at the winter solstice. Well, how about if we say it's Jesus' birthday and we keep the festival and we just repurpose it? You know, in our modern translation, we say, no, we don't want to do that. And this is nothing you haven't heard before. Okay, so moving on in verse 5, but you shall seek the place where the Lord your God chooses out of all your tribes. God is saying, I'm going to appoint up a place, a specific place where you worship me, not just anywhere. He specifically doesn't name that place here. Yeah, Jane? Oh, really?
and it's normally found in that time.
Wow, sounds very druidic. But so, yeah, so it's not just ancient times. You're saying it's going on now today. Yeah, thank you. Okay, I was making the point that God doesn't say Jerusalem here. He says the place that he'll name, leaving himself room to have different places. And you might remember, matter of fact, here's where I think of Jeremiah chapter 7, or in that famous temple sermon, God has Jeremiah say, oh yeah, you think you're so special because you got the temple. Well, go visit Shiloh, where God's name was at first. And that's what happened when the children of Israel came in. They pitched the tabernacle at a place called Shiloh, and it was there for many years. Then later the place would be moved to Jerusalem. And then, of course, Jerusalem would be conquered, and it wouldn't necessarily always be the place. So now, as we're a spiritual temple, we don't see that there has to be one place on earth where we go to worship, especially to sacrifice animals, because we don't have to do that. We do think, though, sometimes we have to have designated places where people gather. And we see, judging from the words of Christ to the apostles, that he does delegate authority to leaders in the church to make those decisions. So we don't have a place, but say in southwestern Ohio, we have a place. You happen to be sitting in it, you know, but that place can change. But so it's, you know, we say that God has delegated authority to name a place where we'll meet for services and for keeping the feasts and things like that. Just made me think it's almost time to register. You guys all know where you're going? Okay, I'm skimming ahead here in verse 5. Verse 6, you'll take your burnt offerings, your sacrifices, your tithes, the heave offerings. So you bring the things dedicated to God. When it says bring your tithes there, it seems to be referring specifically to second tithe. And that'll be elaborated further in chapter 14. Why do I think it's second tithe and not first tithe? Well, what do you do with the first tithe? Okay, you give it to the Levites. And you got Levites right where you are. They're scattered around. The third tithe, later we'll see in chapter 14, was to be kept in their gates and given to the widows and the orphans and such in their area. So the tithe that you took to the place where God put his name, as chapter 14 will show, is the second tithe. So I'm making a mention of that because it comes up here. But otherwise, it's, okay, you bring the animals you're going to sacrifice to God to that particular place. And in verse 7 it says, there you shall eat before the Lord your God and you shall rejoice. Reminds me when I was a kid and my mom would say, you're going to eat it and you'll like it. And I'd say, well, I'll eat it, but I'm not going to like it. Well, God is saying, you're going to do this and you will rejoice. He has a lot more confidence, because if you do things God's way, it brings happiness. So he could say you'll eat it and you'll like it, and he had a way of bringing that to pass. Okay. Yeah, I'm skipping ahead there. He reiterates the idea of in verse 8, don't do all that we're doing here today, whatever's right in your own eyes. It's making the reference to the fact that, okay, we're not set up yet. We've been wandering in the wilderness. You didn't have to worry about finding where God put his name, because you see that pillar of cloud and the tabernacle right in the center of the camp. There's no question about it. But once we cross the Jordan and we spread out and we're settled all over the land, it's going to be important that you know. God will designate a place. That's where you go to sacrifice. You don't sacrifice anywhere else, not on the hilltop, not anywhere else, but where he goes, or where he tells you to go. Verse 13 again. Take heed to yourself that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every place that you see. Verse 14, but in the place which the Lord chooses, and one of your tribes, there offer your burnt offerings, and there you'll do what I command you. Now, he's going to make a difference, though. He's going to make a different point in verse 15. However, you may slaughter and eat meat within all your gates, whatever your heart desires. You know, the clean and the unclean alike. Why is he bothering to make this point? Because some of the sacrifices you would make at Shiloh or later at Jerusalem, it might be a peace offering or a thank offering, and the family gets to eat it. And you have this rejoicing, a big, you know, celebration. So, you know, although like sin offerings and burnt offerings weren't eaten by the people, a lot of offerings and sacrifices that they would make, they would participate in eating. But is that the only time you're allowed to eat meat? You know, does any time you slaughter an animal and have a steak have to be an act of worship? And the answer is no. Say, if you feel like eating meat because you want to eat meat, and he makes that case again later in the chapter, which I don't have it marked. Yes, I do. Yeah, in verse 20, he says, when the Lord your God enlarges your border as he's promised you, and you say, let me eat meat because you long to eat meat, you can eat meat as much as your heart desires. You know, so it you don't have to offer it as a sacrifice to be able to eat meat. That's the point. And then you don't have to be ritually clean or anything like that. You can slaughter an animal, cut up some steaks, or cut it into a stew or whatever you do and eat. But if it is going to be part of sacrificial worship, it has to be at the place where God chooses. And to me, this is a very simple concept, but it's easy as you're reading through these this verbiage to lose track of it all. But it's really a pretty simple thing, which is why I want to move ahead. But I want to stop in verse 17. Again, it'll talk about tithes. You may not eat within your gates the tithe of your grain, your new wine or your oil or the firstborn of your herd, your flocks, or any of your offerings which you vow, your free will offerings. You must eat them before the Lord your God in the place which the Lord your God chooses. Okay, so again, animals that are sacrificed as an act of worship have to be done at the tabernacle and then later when the temple is built there. There's also, again, a mention of a tithe. Okay, here I've got it broken down. What we call first tithe was given to the Levites. You can make a scriptural reference to Numbers 18, verse 24. Numbers 18, 24, God gave the tithe that was God's, still was, but he delegated it to go to the Levites. So the non-Levites weren't allowed to eat that anywhere, anytime. So that's not what he's talking about, take it to where God puts his name and eat it. But the second tithe was to be eaten by the people. You save a different tithe, take it to where God puts his name, and enjoy eating it. Okay, and I've got basically verses 20 through 28. God repeats what he told you. You know, to make sure it's very clear, I'm going to repeat the concept. You know, sacrificial worship, only where I put my name. Eating meat because you feel like eating meat, you can do that wherever you want. And keep in mind, it might have been a bigger deal because they didn't eat meat as often as we do. You know, the principal part of their diet would have been bread, you know, grains and such, and they would have some meat sometimes. But unlike Americans who tend to eat meat every day, sometimes two or three times a day. So we're used to it. For them, it was more of a special occasion. And he goes on to add to that, verse 23, only be sure you do not eat the blood. The blood is the life. You may not eat the life with the meat. He makes that case a number of times, and he's referring back the initial time that was that command was given was Genesis 9, verses 4 and 5. Right after the flood, when God, you know, started anew, and some people suspect that maybe they didn't eat meat at all before the flood. That's speculation. But in any event, whenever you can eat, you know, flesh, you're not allowed to have blood. Oh yeah. Verses 29 to 32 is, I think verse 30 is the one I had on the memory scripture quiz. This is one of the clearest cut statements, where God says, don't use any type of pagan custom to worship me. Verse 29, when the Lord your God cuts off from before you the nations which you go to dispossess and you displace them and dwell in their land, take heed to yourself that you're not ensnared to follow them after they're destroyed. That you don't inquire after their gods, saying, how do these nations serve their gods? I'll do likewise, meaning I'll use their customs to worship my God. He says, no, you shall not worship the Lord your God that way. Why? Every abomination to the Eternal which he hates they've done to their gods. They even burn their sons and daughters in fire to the gods. So they even do child sacrifice. I don't want you trying to worship me that way. Instead, in verse 32, he says, whatever I command you, be careful to observe it. Don't add to it. Don't take away from it. And so this is the pretty clear statement of God saying, I'm telling you how to worship me. Just do that. I can imagine him being, just only do that. It's easy. Don't add to it. Don't take away from it. And the Bible has a lot of track record of them doing exactly what he told them not to. And in human history ever since, we have that as well. Anyways, but I'm not going to elaborate on it more than that. I'm going to take my breath. As we start into chapter 13, I'll note again, scholars who believe that Deuteronomy has an expansion on the Ten Commandments see the third commandment being elaborated not just in this one chapter, but from the beginning of chapter 13 into chapter 14, including chapter 14, verse 21. And some of it, you know, they want to cover the whole patch. Sometimes you see something in there and say, oh, I'm not so sure. But the third commandment was against taking God's name in vain. And here they'll look at false prophets, basically prophesying. They'd say, well, that's, you know, sullying God's name. They're saying they're speaking for God when they're not. And we've also got the repeat of the dietary laws of eating, you know, unclean meats. And they would say, well, God doesn't want you to sully his name by eating things inappropriate. Yes, Julie?
For chapter 13, what commandment is it?
They believe it's the third commandment. Thou shalt not take the name of the Lord your God in vain. This is one that's more of a stretch than some of the others. So again, keep in mind, this is a paradigm that some people have come up with. It's not gospel. It's not something the Bible lays out. But if it's useful, I'm pointing it out to you. Okay, so he starts off talking about false prophets. You know, if there arises among you a prophet or a dreamer of dreams, he gives you a sign or a warning, and the sign or wonder comes to pass. Okay, so he says this is going to happen, and it happens. But then he says, hey, let's go after other gods. Come down here, let's worship this other god. You know, which you haven't known, let us serve them. He says, verse 3, you shall not listen to the words of that prophet or that dreamer of dreams. Why? The Lord your God is testing you to know whether you love the Lord your God with all your heart and all your soul. No, you shall walk after the Lord your God and fear him and his commandments. Serve him, hold fast to him. How do we know if a prophet is true or not? That's one of the things we started off early in the year. Okay, if his prophecy comes true, and it says that later in Deuteronomy 18, verse 22, so we haven't come to it yet. But in this case, he's saying, oh, he says something and it does come true, but there's another criteria. Andrew?
If it goes against what God says.
Okay, if it goes against what God says, then that's exactly the point he's making here. God says, I told you don't worship any other gods, so this is a false prophet. Even if he does something that's true, even if he works miracles. And actually, I've got a reference to 2 Thessalonians 2 and verse 9. 2 Thessalonians 2, 9, that false leaders will, in some cases, through the power of Satan, work signs and lying wonders. So is working a miracle the proof of someone is representing God or not? No, that's not the proof. Does what they teach stand true with God's word? The other place where it discusses that, or the one I like to cite, is Isaiah 8, verse 20. Isaiah 8, 20. The law and the prophets, they speak not according to this word. There's no light in them. And usually when I cite that, I say it's also in Deuteronomy 13, verses 1 through 4, but that's where we're at now. Okay, what's the penalty for these false prophets? Verse 5, put them to death, because they've spoken to turn you away from the Lord your God. So it's a pretty steep penalty. You gotta, you know, it brings capital punishment. Even if it's a close family member. Verse 6, if it's your brother or your mother or your son or daughter or wife or your bosom or your friend who's as your own soul. But he says, let's go secretly serve other gods. You know, verse 8, don't consent to him, don't listen to him. You shall not spare him or conceal him, but you shall surely kill him. Wow. By the way, this was a command for a civil body that had the power to punish crime. So if you have a neighbor or a family member who says, let's go, you know, to the Hindu temple, please don't kill them. We're not teaching that here, you know. None of you even chuckled at that. I'm guessing that means because it never even entered your mind that you might do that. But it's worth making a distinction. That doesn't mean that the principle behind it's not valid. It's just this is the law for a government that has the right to enact the death penalty. We're a church. We don't enact punishment. Okay, which we've covered that here before. I lost my place. What else was I going to say about it? Oh, one other thing, though. It says, you shall kill him. Verse 10, stone him with stones. Back in verse 9, it said, your hand shall be first. So the one making the accusation has to be willing to throw the first stone. Oh, it's not the same thing, but remember in John chapter 8, when they brought to Jesus the woman accused of adultery, and he said, well, whoever's without sin amongst you, let him throw the first stone. And like I said, here it's not saying you have to be without sin, but one of the points is you don't accuse someone and then get someone else to enact the punishment. You know, if you're going to say, hey, this person's leading us into false worship, you'd better be sure, because you're going to have to throw the first stone. And to me, that would be pretty intimidating. I've thrown rocks at people when I was a kid, but never with an intent to kill. And I hope I never am in that case or situation. There's another factor. And actually, I think we've mentioned it before, but if you want the scriptural reference, it'll come up later in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 17, verses 6 and 7. Before the death penalty can be imposed, you have to have something more than just me saying the person deserves it. Okay, you have to have at least two witnesses. That's exactly what I was going for. The word of one witness is not enough. So if I say, David said, let's go worship Molech, and nobody else, I didn't hear him say it. You know, I'm not allowed to throw that first stone, which is good, because David would never worship Molech. I'm pretty sure anyways. Okay, so this is practical. I mean, this is a way of governing. Nowadays, we have, indictment and a grand jury and then panel a jury. And this is a simpler system, but it still was a system with procedures that had to be followed. Okay, verses 12 through 14 will show that it's not just individuals, but whole cities or communities. If someone in one of your cities, which the Lord your God gives you to dwell in, saying, corrupt men have gone out from among you and enticed the inhabitants, well, do you march down there and destroy the city? No, not yet. And verse 14 says, you inquire and search out and ask diligently. You have to have a thorough investigation, presumably by somebody with the authority to do so. You know, we've got judges, there's references to magistrates at different times. So somebody's got to determine whether the city has turned to idolatry or not. Do we have an example of something like this in the Bible? We do. That's why I'm asking. So really I'm asking, do you guys remember where, okay, these people are suddenly turning to worship. Let's check it out. I'm thinking of Joshua. Remember after Gad, Manasseh, or Gad, Reuben, and half of Manasseh, that where you're at? I'm getting, and actually it's in Joshua chapter 22. Remember, they finished fighting. Joshua tells, that the warriors from Reuben, Gad, and half of Manasseh, you did your duty, now you can go home. Go back to Gilead and Bashan. And then they get news, hey, they stopped, and they're building this huge altar. Well, they know they're only supposed to go to one place. We just covered it in Deuteronomy 12. You can't build an altar just anywhere you want. So they went down there to check it out. And they found out, no, it's not for worship. It's just a memorial. They're trying to say, hey, we're still part of you, even though the river comes between us. So in that case, they did a thorough investigation and said, oh, we don't have to kill anybody, which is good. A thorough investigation could go either direction. And you like it when it exonerates somebody and nobody has to die. At least I like that. Okay, if you do have to destroy a city, interesting, verse 15, if you shall surely strike the inhabitants of the city with the edge of the sword, utterly destroying everything in it, the livestock. Verse 16, gather all the plunder into the middle and completely burn it with fire and all its plunder. So if we follow this law, there's no incentive to make a false accusation against a city. I don't say, they're devil worshippers, let's go kill them all and take their gold. No, you don't get any of the gold or their animals or anything. So if you follow the law properly, there's no incentive to make a false accusation. You're not going to get rich off of it. And I think that was God's intention here. No, you don't get any booty. You're just enforcing what's good and right. I wanted to go with something else about that. Yeah, in verse 17, so none of the accursed things shall remain in your hand that the Eternal may turn from the fierceness of his fierceness of his anger and show mercy and have compassion and multiply you just as he swore to your fathers. So God is saying, look, things will be good if you obey me. But he seems to be making a case, you know, what was going to happen to the Canaanites once they crossed the Jordan? What did God tell the Israelites to do to them? Kill them, destroy them. What is it? Harem, you know, utterly destroy them. This is saying, you Israelites, you go worship false gods. You're no better than they are. You'll get totally destroyed. So God's not a racist. Hey, I'm going to destroy the Canaanites for false worship. You Israelites, I'll destroy you for false worship. If you worship false gods, don't do that. You know, I'm setting you up for a special purpose. And of course, we know the resurrection is going to give all those people another chance when that time comes. Okay. Moving on, we go into chapter 14. You are the children of the Lord your God. Don't cut yourselves or shave the front of your head for the dead. Why? Because you're a holy people. The Lord your God has chosen you. Don't eat any detestable thing. God is making a point, as children of God, as God's separate people, I don't want you to do what the other people do as part of their worship. Don't defile your body with pagan practices. This goes back to what we covered in Leviticus chapter 19 in a number of places. Yes, Andrew?
This may mean nothing,
but it may mean something. So,
in my margin,
it says for cut or shave the front of your head.
Mm-hmm.
It says make any baldness between your eyes.
Oh. Yeah, which it's. I mean, I think that's the literal Hebrew, okay. And they took that as okay, shaving. So the idea, it's not saying you can never shave any hair. I mean, otherwise, well, in some Orthodox Jews have taken it that way. That's why you see those beards. You know, they all look like they're part of ZZ Top. I heard ZZ Top on the radio this weekend. I thought, wow, I haven't heard any music by them in ages. We don't think it's that. It is connected to doing this for the sake of, you know, how they worship the dead or they try to contact the dead. Don't disfigure your faces. Don't make cuttings. You know, a lot of the Canaanites would shave patterns into the sides of their head for particular reasons. You know, and of course we covered how back in Deuteronomy 19 he says that, and then it also says don't print any marks or don't tattoo any marks. And there's been the discussion in the church. Is it you can't have a tattoo if it's to reverence the dead or try to contact them, or was there a period and just don't print any marks on you? And the church has debated back and forth. Our current teaching, which I think is correct, is no, just don't print any marks and don't disfigure yourself. Don't do any of that. You know, I don't want you being like those people. Some pagan religions have done that, and notably there are the Canaanites. My experience studying American history, a lot of the American Indian tribes did things like that. And I think the ones in the southern hemisphere more than the northern, but I'm not sure. I mean, the American Indians did some weird stuff. And of course, they do weird stuff to the people they captured, which was even worse. But the point is God saying, don't do that. I want you to keep your bodies pure the way I gave them to you. And that includes in what you eat. Okay, and I'm not going to go through it all again, but verses 3 through 20 repeat the dietary laws from Leviticus 11. And I think the emphasis is that even though we could say there are health benefits, because there are health benefits, it's healthier if you don't eat pork and shellfish and all that. But the reason God gives is because you're a holy and a special people. You know, and health benefits seem to be a nice aside. I will mention, because I said this repeats what's in Leviticus 11, it's not exactly word for word. So there are some variations in the wording, but there aren't any contradictions. And it's also worth noting, which I can't remember if I said this in Leviticus, you know, the animal names that we have listed, especially where it's listing the birds, you know, they're the best guesses we have for some Hebrew words. Like, what's the Hebrew word for ostrich? I think that one they have pretty clear. But the little owl, the screech owl, the white owl, you know, what are white owl cigars? They still make those? I don't know. I was going to say I haven't smoked any cigars in a long time, but actually it's been like 54 years. I've never smoked a cigar. Don't intend to. But so, you know, a lot of these words we think we have correct, but we don't know. But we're pretty clear on most of this. Chapter 14, verse 8, it mentions also, don't eat their flesh or touch their dead carcasses. So touching the dead body of an unclean animal would bring, we believe it's referring specifically to ritual uncleanness. Partly because we see it more, it's explained in more detail in Leviticus. Such as in Leviticus 11, verse 31, it makes it more clear that, okay, touching it makes you unclean until evening, and you have to wash your body. That's not covered here. So what we see is it seems a little bit of a restrict or a combining the fact that, okay, you're ritually unclean if you touch a dead body. But we believe the principle of holiness applies even without the temple, that God doesn't want us eating those things. By the way, he doesn't want us messing with dead bodies. But, you know, we're not restricted from going to the temple because we don't have a physical temple. It's worth noting, because some people get hung up. Yeah, I remember when I was young saying, can I use a football? Because they call it a pigskin. Although I think a lot of times they use cow leather these days. But Leviticus 11, verse 39, makes the point that touching the dead body of a clean animal also makes you unclean until evening. So dead bodies, period, bring uncleanness. And the idea is, okay, take care of yourself. You know, nowadays, well, I think of what I hear my wife tell my son over and over and over again. Yeah, three words, wash your hands. It's not about being unclean till evening, but he's outside picking up worms and anything, digging in the dirt, wash your hands, you're unclean. You know, it's not necessarily about the temple, but God knew about bacteria and such well before people. So I think some of his laws did have that under, you know, that's, I would say a subsidiary reason, but the reason he gives, once again, is holiness. Wants us to be holy and pure. And that's a good reason, even if we don't understand any others. And I want to emphasize that because some people say, well, yeah, but we can process pork now and have it raised so that it's healthy for you. My answer would be that might be true, but that's not the main reason God said not to eat it. He didn't say whether or not it's healthy. He said, I want you to be pure and clean. Anyways, let's move on from there. Actually, there's something I'd point out in verse 21 regarding that. You shall not eat anything that dies of itself. That's clean or unclean. But you may give it to the alien that's within your gates that he may eat it. Or you may sell it to a foreigner. But you are a holy people. The point I'm making is, okay, this the principle of whether you can eat something that dies on its own or not, that's not part of the moral eternal law, because if it were, it wouldn't be okay to sell it to someone else. This is related to the ritual pureness. That a moral principles apply to everyone at all times in every place. Some of the ritual laws were for the people of Israel in that particular system. I'd still be wary about eating something that dies on its own. You know, don't visit the roadkill cafe. You know, it's probably better even if they have, you know, well, usually they have a possum and who knows what else. You know, if I see, well, anyways, I could get sidetracked, which I'm not going to. I'll remind us, though, the principle of not eating blood is one that's consistent. It was mentioned for all people at all times. So it's not just a ritual thing. It goes all the way back to Genesis and continue. Okay, chapter 14, verse 21 also mentions the not boiling a young goat in its mother's milk. Again, it's like, come on, how often did they want to do this? Apparently, it was a pretty common thing. And I'll mention again, as I did when we covered it earlier, if you want the earlier references, it's in Exodus 23, 19, and also Exodus 34, 26. Our understanding is that was a practice that the Canaanites did as part of a fertility ritual. They would boil the kid in its mother's milk, make a broth, and sprinkle it on the fields and on the trees, supposedly so they have a better crop next year. This is another case of God saying, don't do that. Just pray to me. Obey my law. I'll give you the early rain and the latter rain, and I'll bless your crops. You don't got to do this boiling a kid thing. But specifically, this is not about not eating meat and dairy together, as Orthodox Jews interpret it. You know, that's where they get that. You can't eat meat and dairy together. That's not what this is about. So cheeseburgers are fine. Yeah, Exodus 23:19 and 34:26. As I said, it's in there three different times, and that might be part of the reason, as I said, the Orthodox Jews have latched on to it, and other people say, is there more to this than we think? I think it's because it was a widespread practice. Just like today, he might say, don't send Christmas cards. I don't care if your Aunt Mildred really likes you and she sends you $5 every year. Don't send Christmas cards like the heathen do. Only we don't call our aunts and uncles heathen. Well, actually, I think I used to sometimes, but not around them. I've outgrown some of these things. Okay, I'm going to pause. Sorry. starting in verse 22, okay, we're moving to what the paradigm of expanding on the Ten Commandments. Scholars who think we're moving into the fourth commandment. So starting with Deuteronomy 14, verse 22, all the way through Deuteronomy 16, verse 17. So this breakdown spans chapters, which is inconvenient for us. But as I said, this isn't something, and by the way, I don't have any questions on the test about this, so I'm giving it to you just for informational purposes. But the fourth commandment, which is, of course, remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. It becomes more clear because we see references to the holy days, but we'll also begin talking about the land Sabbath. So all of these seem to be expansions of the weekly Sabbath. And we start off, well, actually in verse 22, with the tithe. And then specifically as related to the second tithe, which is a festival tithe, we call it, and that's why we're relating it to the Sabbath. Verse 22, you shall surely tithe the increase of your grain that the field produces. You shall eat before the Lord your God in the place where he chooses to make his name abide. The tithe of your grain, your new wine, your oil. First, so the idea is all of the increase, not just grain, any of your increase. And if instead of grain and new wine, you get a check with money, tithe on that, which I think we all know. And if the journey's too far, you're not able to carry the tithe, we covered this, of course, last fall, turn it into money and take it in your hand and then go to the place where the Lord puts his name and spend that money for whatever your soul desires. Okay, again, we're certain this can't be first tithe. As we discussed earlier, Numbers 18:24, God is very clear. The tithe belongs to God and he gives the tithe to the Levites. And the Levites have to give a tithe of their money to the priests. So this can't be that tithe, because if you get to give it to the Levites, you're not allowed to have it. How could you take it to the place where God puts his name? So it only makes common sense to say it's a different tithe, or we would say a second tithe. And it describes what that tithe is for. It's for keeping specifically the Feast of Tabernacles. Although it's worth noting, they had what they called three pilgrimage festivals. They would go for the spring festivals. And we see an example of Jesus Christ. Remember when his parents left Jerusalem and thought he was in the company when he was 12 and they had come back and find him? So a lot of times people would travel for the spring holy days and for Pentecost, then in the fall. The reason I'm saying that is most of our second tithe will go for the Feast of Tabernacles. That's when we have the greatest expense. But if you have an expense like you're hosting the night to be much observed at your house, it's okay to pay for that with second tithe. You know, because it's a festival, you know, expense. So things like that. Now, I wouldn't say, oh, I need a new color TV so I can catch up on the news. I'm going to use my second tithe for that. Okay, what are appropriate uses? Remember when we did the five W's of the FOT? It seems to be one is for travel. Nowadays, we say travel and lodging. Take it, go to the place where God chooses to put his name. Obviously, food. Spend it on whatever your heart rejoices. You know, sheep or oxen. Wine, and then I another category that is my personal interpretation, but in the latter part of verse 26, it says, and you shall rejoice. So what category is spending your second tithe on rejoicing that's not food or drink? Because I rejoice in food and drink. I've noticed I do that a lot more now that I'm older. When I was 11, my very first Feast of Tabernacles, I wasn't as excited about that. You know what I was excited about? What? I was going to say go-karts. I had heard stories about if you go to the Lake of the Ozarks or the Feast of Tabernacles, they've got go-karts. My grandma told me about this. I wanted to ride go-karts so much. I rejoiced in that. Trying to think if we actually rode go-karts that year. Because I know, well, I've done it other years at the feast, actually as an adult. Sue and I went, and when we were in Gatlinburg, we went up to Pigeon Forge and rode go-karts. What's funny is, if you ever see Sue riding in go-karts, she puts her foot about halfway down, where everyone else is zipping by. To me, when I'm doing a go-kart, my foot goes to the floor and it stays there. There's no slowing down because they don't go that fast. Anyways, to me, that's a matter of rejoicing. So I'm saying, I think it's appropriate to use second tithe for some things besides travel, lodging, and food. This is a long way to get there. The other thing I point out in verse 27 is a hint of that. You shall not forsake the Levite within your gates. That seems to be, is that saying make sure you share your second tithe with the Levites? Possibly, or it's a lead in to what we're going to discuss next. But I also refer to the description in Nehemiah. Now my mind's going blank. I can't remember chapter 7 or chapter 9. When they were keeping the feast and the people started weeping and they said, no, this is a feast day. Rejoice. Go eat, drink. Send portions to those for whom nothing is prepared. I see that as an indication that sharing with others who might have less than you is a very appropriate use for your second tithe. And that's something, it's easy to overlook, and it could be taken too far. But, you know, there are things that it's appropriate to use second tithe for. There are things that it's not appropriate. And we have these broad guidelines, so there's room to discuss. As I said, you know, okay, is it okay for me to get a new pair of shoes? You know, well, I've never bought new running shoes at the feast, but I've bought new dress shoes. And so you can break it down different ways. But that's a discussion for another time. Okay, moving on though. Verse 27 talks about the Levite. Verse 28, at the end of every third year, bring out the tithe of your produce and store it up within your gates. Now, wait a minute. Numbers 18 said I had to give the tithe to the Levite. Numbers 14 says I have to take it to the place where God puts his name. Now it's telling me I have to store it in my gate and do what with it? Give it to the stranger, the fatherless, and the widow, and they have to come to your gate and eat it. Now, okay, this is a different thing. Our interpretation and that of the Jews over the years has been that this is yet another tithe, which is why we call it third tithe. And it seems to be saying the third tithe isn't one that's collected every year, but every third year. And I almost forgot, of course, you guys have covered the doctrine of tithing. No? Oh, okay. So, well, I can be more brief. But okay, so... okay, this is a tithe that every third year, some people say in a seven-year cycle, which we're going to discuss a seven-year cycle coming up, that it's the third and sixth year of the cycle, and then you have the seventh year release, and then you start counting from one again. So that it's not strictly every 3 years, but every third and sixth. That's one interpretation. Another interpretation is no, it's every one, two, three. One, two, three, one, two, three. I don't know exactly which. But we see this is for providing for others, for the widow, the orphan, the poor, needy. Okay, there's a question, and I'm sure Mr. McNeely is going to explore this with you to some degree. Is this part of the moral law for all time that we have to keep, or was this part of the civil law for a nation? Okay, we've interpreted both ways. When I was your age, we taught, no, we all have to do this. And on third tithe, you know, in your third tithe year, you make sure you set that aside and you send a check in and you say it's for third tithe. And some people still do that, but the way I'm wording it probably leads you to think, well, wait a minute, it sounds like we're not necessarily. And partly because we see the moral principle of providing this amount for the poor and needy as a moral obligation for all people for all time. The specifics of how it's done by different governments could be done in different ways. And part of the reason we were forced to look at this is, especially in the post-World War II era, when a lot of nations and a lot of European nations set very high tax rates, you know, sometimes upwards of 50%, we had church members that said, wait a minute, if I do first tithe, second tithe, and third tithe, I have no money left to buy groceries for me. I have to pay, I need third tithe support for me to live. We said, maybe we need to rethink this. And we looked at part of the money that the government takes from our checks, whether we like it or not, is used for exactly this purpose, to support the widows and the orphans and the needy. And if you do a calculation, it's not hard to discover that it's more, they actually take more from us for that purpose than would be if we did our third tithe. So we could say in one sense, this is both an eternal moral obligation, but it's also a particular procedure within a government. And our interpretation of the church has been, if you're comfortable saying, okay, the government is taking my money and using it for this, I've met my obligation that we see here in Deuteronomy, then that's okay. Yes, Charles?
Also be fulfilled, like, for example, if you give, like, to a charity every month?
Possibly. Now, we did it within the church, and we still tell people, hey, you know, it's good, you know, we have people who are needy that the church provides for. And I'm giving you a brief overview, as I thought, if Mr. McNeely is going there next, I'll let him take the time and fill in the more details. One of the points I want to make sure clear, though, is we don't say, oh, third tithe doesn't matter anymore. It's a matter of how it's administered. We believe that is a firm principle, and if the government weren't doing it, it would be obligatory on us to do it, to make sure we provide it. And that's where we'll stop. So we'll pick up with chapter 15.